Tonight's 10-minute speaker is Victoria from Slow.
Thanks, Frank. I'm Victoria. I'm an alcoholic. It's a bright light. Wow. So I'll tell you, hopefully, in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. That's really hard to do in 10 minutes. I did a lot of awful, shameful things, and I usually go off in that direction, but a lot of good things have happened in my life recently, so what it's like now might take center stage. But I don't know. I don't plan this. I'll just tell the truth. I will just tell the truth, which is something I had a complete inability to do before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's for darn sure. I started drinking a little bit in high school, not too much. I went to a private school, and then drinking got really heavy, and it became a big part of my life in college, which is a pretty common thing. But what I found that's not common among normal drinkers is that alcohol did something to me that it didn't do to them. It totally transformed me from the inside out. I mean, outside of the stumbling around and doing all the awful, embarrassing things, it made me feel things I'd never felt. It made me feel like I belonged. It made me feel like I could kind of fit in when I'd never felt that before in my whole life. I've always felt different, and I always felt like I was alone. In every classroom, in every family gathering, I mean, I just always felt like I was completely different. And once I started drinking, I felt like I could sort of fit in. But right away, the first time I ever drank, I was given a big bottle of vodka. In high school, I snuck out with my brother's friends, and they just said to drink it, and I did. And that first night, I mean, the very first night, I woke up, I came to in a guy's car that I didn't know, and I panicked and ran. I mean, it was like the very first night. It was just awful. And I didn't stop until 4 years and 4 months ago. I did things like that all the time. And I came close to death so many times, and I woke up so embarrassed, covered in pee, covered in vomit, in strangers' beds, like, and none of that was enough, you know, to get me to stop. And when I knew it was time to stop, I had an inability to stop. Something that the book talks about that really resonates with me, I didn't start my timer. Sorry. Something that the book talks about that really resonates with me is that is the definition of an alcoholic, because for a long time I didn't understand why I drank the way that I drank and other people didn't, because I would start my night toward the end there when I was really trying to control and manage my drinking after a car wreck that almost killed 4 people, a year sentence in county jail, a bunch of locations across the country, moving in with people that I met playing Yahtzee on the internet. That happened twice. And both of them were people in Chicago, and I lived here, and I moved to Chicago in the middle of the worst winter they have seen in decades in 2011, and I just, like, hit it hard. You know, those relationships didn't work. And, you know, the guy that I met on Yahtzee, it was fine because he had 5 best friends living in that house. And that meant that I had 4 other people to bounce around to, you know, just to, until I had peed in all of their beds. And I did. All of them. And, you know, and it's kind of funny because I unashamedly tell you that that's where drinking takes me. But what it does for me is why I drink. The book says that we drink because we essentially like the effects produced by alcohol, and that's why I drink. Despite all of those awful, incomprehensible demoralization, despite all of that, I drank all the time. And it's because I like the effects produced by alcohol. I would start drinking, and it got me out of my crazy head. I would start drinking, and it would turn off the voice that told me that I was never good enough, that I was just an awful piece of crap that no one cared about. All of that stuff was shut off when I'd start drinking. And so despite all of those awful consequences, I didn't stop drinking until I came close to losing a really close relationship that somehow meant something to me after I had blown through all the others. And what happened is that someone recommended I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I could tell a million stories of what it was like, but I got brought down to my knees with shame. I just woke up for the last time feeling completely ashamed of who I was, what I had done, and I had no idea why, because like I had done 100 times, I had started that night telling myself I was just going to drink a couple drinks. And I couldn't. I just can't. I'm an alcoholic, and once I start drinking, I can't stop. And so, finally, I woke up for the last time feeling the shame that I'm sure plenty of you are familiar with, where you just can't stand yourself for doing the same thing you said you wouldn't do 100 times over. And I asked for help. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't linear for me. I came, I didn't get it, I didn't want it, I was too smart, I was smarter than you, and I was going to do it by myself. That's just what it was like for me. I didn't listen to you. I thought all that you had to say were lies, or that you were manipulating me, or that you hadn't really had it as bad as me, so you couldn't possibly understand why I drank. But I quit drinking because I didn't want to be in that shameful place anymore, and I stopped drinking for a year without doing anything. No book, no sponsor, not meetings. It was just, it wasn't great. And I met a friend who was really, really plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said lovingly on a hike, "I think I have a phone number for a lady you really should call. You know, you just call her. It'd really be good for you." And for some reason, I called her. I mean, I just never wanted help until that point, and I called her. And I started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're detailed in the big book. I read the big book, and when I read it, especially the beginning, I just heard for the first time that someone knew what I was going through. Someone else couldn't control their drinking. Someone else wanted to so badly. Someone else put whiskey and milk together. Like, someone else, like, knew what I was going through. And it resonated with me, and this woman didn't judge me. I told her about all the things that I had done, and she just said, "Yeah, me too. I've gone through that stuff too." I told her about the huge lies I had told, the money I had stolen from church, the pills I had stolen from cancer patients and an MS stepfather of mine, all of it. I told her all of it, and she loved me. And you guys do. You guys continue to love me, even though I don't drink and I'm still so imperfect. And it's really it's been a blessing. What it's like now. I got married 3 weeks ago. I only mention that because I swear to God, I could not stay faithful to anyone for 5 minutes, let alone for 5 years. I tell this person the truth about everything, and I couldn't tell the truth to anyone before. I'm having a baby, and I'm going to be a sober mom. Like, you know, and I say that too because without this program, I would have none of this. I would have no self-respect, and I walk around today with my head up, and I can look people in the eye, and I don't steal from my job, and I don't take people's pills, and I don't crash my car into their kids. And, you know, I say that really black and white because that's who I was before. I would do that, and then I would blame you. Like, that's just the life I lived, and I've been set free by this program. If you're new, Victoria, Fran, Matt, Jamie, I think, I'm so freaking glad you're here. I'm really glad you're here, and if I don't say anything that you relate to, come back, please. Come back to a totally different meeting. Come back to this one. Talk to someone after the meeting. Just keep coming, because it took me like a year. But I've been set free, and I stay free because I stay committed to service in this program. I tell the truth every day. I have a higher power of my own understanding that no one told me to believe in. I'm of service to others. I go to meetings regularly, and I just take this one day at a time. I don't know if I said anything that will resonate with you guys, but it means a lot to me that you're here because I know that I'm like you, hopefully, and you're like me, and this really works. So thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Brent from Springfield.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Brent, and I am an alcoholic. Let me find some place to put this thing. There we go. Okay, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It is a pleasure to be able to honor the podium and represent the fellowship that saved my life, saved others' lives, and to be able to tell you my side of the story. By the way, Victoria, I'd like to welcome you to Bladder Control Anonymous. I love that. I couldn't resist that. I'm sorry. I just got to give her a bad time. My sobriety date is April 18th, 1989, 11,261 days ago. And that is an unbelievable miracle. My home group is a place called the Springville Gut Level Group. Of course, that name has a story behind it. When the Gut Level Group was first formed in Springville, it was in the early 50s, and they were so afraid of doing their fourth and fifth step wrong, particularly the fifth step, they would bring the fifth step to a meeting and share it in a meeting to the businessmen they cheated, to the husbands of the wives they've cheated with, and the fathers of the daughters that they've been chasing. That's gut level AA. I was raised by a good Christian family. They were churchgoers, nearly teetotalers. I was raised on a working cow-calf cattle ranch, doing all the things that cattle people do. I rode horses, fed hay, fixed fence, cured cattle, did all of this. My boss, first boss, was my dad. I worked on the ranch for him. Didn't get paid a whole lot, but then, you know, that's not ranching. When I was 10 years of age, my dad said, you know, I think I'd rather have you riding for me than a lot of the adults that I can hire to come and work. Because, first of all, I could ride well. I was a good horseman. Second, I knew the ranch. I knew all the rocks and gullies. And I knew what dad wanted, and I knew where he wanted the cows. So that was always kind of cool. I had a brother that was 15 years older. He was really more of a, almost a boss than he was a brother. I started Springville School in elementary school, first grade. They didn't have kindergarten then, 1950, so you know how old I am. Population then was about 400 students. The first eighth grades were there, no kindergarten at Springville. Up to about fourth grade, I did pretty good. I learned to play clarinet in the fourth grade, did okay until sixth grade. And about that time, I really kind of think the ism was beginning to raise its ugly head, and I began to get very lazy. The sixth and seventh grades at Springville School were not good. They're not bad, but, you know, I was being lazy. I wasn't doing the work very well. I wasn't a behavior problem. I was a pretty good kid. I had been raised that way. But in eighth grade, the folks decided to take me out of Springville School and send me down to a junior high, and I ran into an old-style school marm, Miss Davis. Let me tell you what, her method of teaching, she would intimidate you. She couldn't believe when I had been at Springville School, I hadn't been taught some of the English. And so she proceeded to really get after me. And one of the things we did, any of you ever diagram sentences when you, I see a couple of hands. Okay, if you don't even have any idea what diagramming sentences is, ask them. But at Bartlett, I got into the marching band, and I discovered a love of music. Boy, it was great. I even did my homework. I practiced. I graduated eighth grade, went into Porterville High, got into the Porterville High School band immediately. The director was a gentleman by the name of Buck Schaefer, very well known in music circles, if you happen to know anything about it. So fourth period was my best period of the day. That was band, and that was a cool place. We marched in the band. I played clarinet one year. My sophomore year for concert season after the marching season, Buck put me on a bass clarinet. And if you know anything about band organization, the inside row, we started over here with the director. The first four seats were first clarinets. Two bass clarinets was where I was with another guy. And then the rest of this circle was flutes. And on the end of my sophomore year, there was an opportunity to try out for drum major. I did. I was built a little different then. I became drum major. And in about the middle of June, we started something called summer band. Buck would always bring in band kids. And the new kids, the freshmen that were coming in, got to come in and learn to play the music so that when school started in September, we had a band that could play a halftime show or could play music for games and all of this good stuff. And there was an empty seat on my left, on the flute row. There was one empty seat. And this absolutely gorgeous Fox walks into the band room carrying a flute case, would you believe? Hello there. I was dating the other end of the flute row, I want you to know. But she was busy talking. And Buck waved, if she wasn't, I pretended she was. And Buck waved this little girl onto the seat next to mine, and I turned to her almost immediately, and I said, by the way, I have a bet with my buddy over here that I can find out your name and how old you are before he can. She says, I'm Sharon Ryan, and I'm 14 years old. I nudged him and said, see, I got it. He said, about what? What did you get? I hadn't said a word to him. In March of the following year, her freshman year, we started dating. She was 14, I was 16. Within 6 months, we started talking about, well, do you suppose we would ever get married? I mean, we weren't talking about getting married, but we were talking about, do you think this is something, is this serious? And it was. In reality, neither one of us ever looked back. It was a love affair that started at 14 and 16, and we never quit. I graduated from high school in 1962. They sent me down to Bakersfield College. I became drum major of the band at Bakersfield College. Oh, boy, what a deal. I lived in the dorms, but guess what? The lazies returned big time. I had a very consistent grade point average. It went down every semester. After three semesters at Christmas time, I got a letter which said, your grades are so bad, you will not be allowed to re-enroll. No, I didn't flunk out of college. They just didn't want me back. So I came home. I went to work on the ranch again. In March of 1964 that year, a friend of mine who was 2 years younger, in fact, one of the guys that called me this morning was this same guy. Steve went with me on a trip this morning. And he got drafted in the Army. That's when there was a draft. I no longer had a student deferment. I didn't want to go in the Army with Jerry. So I went down and talked to the Coast Guard, and I got an enlistment date of the 7th of July. At Easter vacation that year, with her parents' agreement, I gave Sharon a diamond. We got engaged in her senior year. And in June of 1964, she graduated from Porterville High School, and she immediately went to work for the telephone company and moved to Los Angeles. In July, I went to boot camp up in Alameda, and I immediately tried out for the band again because this is a good deal. And I got into the band, so when my company, Charlie Company, would go to the grinder to high port their M1s, I would go to the band room because I had to practice. I knew how to do that. I qualified for electronics technician, a six-month school. If I came out as an ET, I would most probably go to isolated duty for 6 months. We wanted to get married so that when I came off of isolated duty, I'd probably get a ship somewhere and be with there. But she could get moved in and come to me. And, you know, that was long before the time when the couples would live together a while. We're old time. Anyway, but the battle between Sharon and I and her folks and my folks was pretty ugly. And we wanted to get married before I left for ET school. They wanted us to wait, of course. And one of my really serious drunks occurred on the way back to Alameda after we had had a very rousing and rather ugly fight with both sets of parents. And I was drinking, but not real heavily. Just I had this binge, and I got roaringly drunk, and, you know, the motel was never the same. But on March 27th of 1965, I married my high school sweetheart. We had a one-week honeymoon. She went back to work at the phone company. We lived in a motel for a few days until she put me on a plane to Connecticut. But I knew when I went to Connecticut, maybe I need to grow up a little. And I told her I had to make this school work. After a month of school, I called her, and my grades were in the mid-90s. What a surprise. All you had to do was study. Who thought? Anyway, I called her, and I said, I want you to come back to New London, Connecticut with me. I'll find an apartment. Come on back. I did. She joined me. She went to work for the telephone company there in New London. And I had what was known as Cinderella Liberty. I would get off at 4 o'clock, 1600 for those of you that want to know that, on Friday afternoon. And at 1 a.m. on Sunday morning, you turned into a pumpkin. You had to be back on the base by 1 a.m. Well, needless to say, being married and having an apartment and doing what young married people do, we had to make several very rapid trips across the Thames River back to the base about 1255. On August 4th, 1790, a group called the United States Coast Guard was formed, so they always have a little bit of a party on the first Saturday thereafter. It was August 7th, 1965, and that's an important date. We went to a park. We had baseball, volleyball, football, steak, beer, and hard liquor. And I got good and drunk. Let me tell you. I got back to the apartment. Sharon was not happy with me. But 3 months into ET school, I got an opportunity to change over to aviation electronics. I spent a month in radio school in Connecticut, and then we transferred to Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And she went to work for Sears down there, and out of the AT school in Elizabeth City, I got transferred to the 12th Coast Guard District and went to the Coast Guard Air Station in San Diego, and that's where we moved. We drove across the U.S. in a Corvair pulling a U-Haul. That's about to look interesting. Sharon went back to work for the phone company, but now she was a service rep. But in San Diego, my drinking career began to kind of go up. We used to have once a month a steak and beer day, and it would be something that all the duty sections could have steak and have beer. The duty section had to refrain from the beer because they would go back to work for the afternoon and then spend the night on base. But there was a bunch of us that decided there was absolutely no reason to send a keg back to the liquor store with any beer in it. So we proceeded to go out and attempt to empty the kegger, and we sat there and got completely sloshed. And of course, you know that when you drink beer, you got to do something with the liquid. And it was a long ways back to the head and the barracks. So we walked out to the edge of San Diego Bay, and there were rocks to keep it from corroding. And we stepped up on the rocks, and there's a whole string of coasties out there trying to fill the bay. A father went by with his two teenage daughters, and when the girls giggled and started laughing, he almost broke the throttle level trying to get that boat out of sight, because today we'd probably be arrested for indecent exposure, but, you know, we did what we did. I fell on a rack. I woke up en route to the John, vomited violently, and I drove home very, very carefully. I called my wife, and I said, take the bus home. She walked in, and she said, this place smells like a brewery. Again, she was not real happy. In May of 1968, I was due to get out July 6th, but my father and my brother were both injured on the ranch the same day, and they needed me home to help on the ranch. So May 17th of 1968, about a little bit early, 3 years, 10 months, 11 days, and exactly 2 hours after I'd raised my right hand and said I do, we drove off base. Back on the ranch, working for my father and my brother again, the drinking incrementally ticked up. It never just flew away, but it was getting there. My father chewed me out severely one Sunday morning because I not only smelled like a brewery, I could barely stand up on the back of the truck and feed hay, and he was not impressed. I reeked of booze. And from 68 until 85, my drinking kept doing this along. Not real fast, and I was still having fun, mostly, but there was a few problems. In 1971, I left the ranch to partner with my father-in-law at Whitridge Tire Shop. By 1973, we were bankrupt. Probably not because of my drinking, but that didn't help any. I returned to college at Cal State Bakersfield, and I earned a degree in business and public Let me start again. Business and public administration with a concentration in accounting. It takes me longer to say it than it did to get it. I graduated in 1975, and I'm sure you'll be shocked to know I gave the radical speech at graduation. I shocked the dean of the college so bad he forgot to confer degrees. I went to work for Dean Witter as a stockbroker. We nearly starved to death there, and I left them in 1978. With a bachelor's degree, I could teach school, so I went to Porterville High School, and I taught high school for a while. In 1986, I began teaching in a dropout diversion program. The drinking had really begun to pick up now. The kids were extremely difficult. This was a dropout diversion program. If I had a nickel for every F-bomb that was dropped in class to me or at me or around me, I could retire with great ease. They were a rough bunch of kids. But I was also the trainer for the football team. And I can remember walking towards the building where the kids would be getting into uniform and I would be taping ankles pretty quick. I remember checking my watch and saying, well, I can drink in 3 more hours. I didn't remember doing that until I got sober, but I was doing it. I remember then, later, a little I would. 1989, the right year now, we finally made it up to 89. I had a blackout. I'd been cooking a half a turkey breast on the grill. I remember taking it off the grill. I remember serving it up. I remember having seconds, and that's where my remembering stopped. I was jogging then, which I could use again, but I'm not going to. 2 miles out, I turned back and turned around into the sunlight, and all of a sudden, that sunlight in my eyes, and I realized, oh my gosh, I have had a blackout. Now, I was educated. I had a college degree. I'm a teacher. I'm married with 3 boys. Nobody eats enough Twinkies to blackout. You don't drink enough water to black out. I knew there was something wrong and that this wasn't cool. I walked into my classroom that day, and there was a young girl, 15 years old. I can still see this young lady. She was attending meetings, and I knew she was. I cornered her, and I said, told her what had happened, that I had done this. And she looked at me, and she said, Mr. Gill, you had a blackout. I said, yes. Then I asked her the hardest question I think I've ever asked. Does that make me an alcoholic? She says, Mr. Gill, only you can decide that. Well, thanks a lot. That's not what I needed. How do I find that out? She said, I'll bring you some information. You seen that salmon-colored slip that has 20 questions on it, that has the 3 explanations on the bottom? Well, she brought me that, and I took it and sat down at my desk. I wasn't going to make any marks on it. These kids are around. I don't want them to see what I did. So I first time through, I found 3 answers that I could answer yes. And I thought, well, that's really not too bad. Then I went to the bottom. And this is not exactly what it said, but it's close. It says, if you have 1 or more, you might have a problem. Be careful. If you have 2 or more, you probably have a little bit of a problem. You probably ought to talk to somebody. And then what I read for number 3 that says, if you have 3 or more, bend over, kiss yourself on the rear end, use one of us. And that's what I heard. All right. Later, with a little more honesty, I found out that I could answer 7. Yes. I had a business meeting with a man that I knew would be a sober member of AA. After the meeting, I told him my tale. He said, I said, I've never been arrested. I've never had a DUI. I've never lost a job. I've still got my wife. I've still got my house. I've still got my car. I've never lost any of these things. Very wise man. He looked at me and he said, add 1 word, and I'll believe every word you just said. I said, what's that? And he said, yep. Ouch. I knew I had heard the truth. He could have hit me with a 50-pound sack of cement in the gut, and it wouldn't have caught me any worse, because you know when you've heard the truth. I knew I'd heard the truth. And he said, oh, by the way, here's a big book back there. Grab that. Read the first 164 pages. And by the way, there's a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. Come on up. All you got to do is say, hi, I'm Brent. You don't have to say anything else. You're fine. I took it home. I skimmed through those pages, and in typical fashion, I said, wow, that's pretty good stuff if you need it. At the meeting, there was a local group of fifth chapter writers. Now, if you don't know who they are, if you've been around here long enough, you know who fifth chapter was, but they were clean and sober bikers. And there was more tattoos, bandanas, camel cigarettes rolled in shirt sleeves, you know, that whole bit. And the national president of Fifth Chapter lived over in Visalia, which is about 40 miles from us. And he got up and he started talking about serenity. He talked about getting up in the middle of the night, having to go to the bathroom, come back, crawl back in bed, and go right back to sleep. And I'm listening to that going, how in the world does he do that? I can't do that. I get up, I'm up. Well, I wanted what he had. So that night I spoke a little bit, I shared, and I said, you know, I don't know what I am. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I don't know what the deal is. And several people spoke to that. By the following weekend, I was convinced, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, I think. So I'm out jogging, and I'm practicing, and I'm saying, hi, my name is Brent, and I'm an Hi, my name is Brent, and I'm an didn't want to come out. Okay. The following Thursday night was our AA meeting up in Springville, and it was my 45th belly button birthday. I was a slow learner. And I walked into that meeting, and I sat down, and when they came to me, I said for the very first time anywhere, hi, my name is Brent, and I am an alcoholic. The man who was to become my sponsor a little bit later was sitting right behind me, and he reached out and he squeezed my shoulder, and he said about 10,000 words by just touching me and squeezing my shoulder. For several months, I thought 3 months, I worked on my sobriety. Life was relatively uneventful, and one Saturday night, I got a call from my brother Dale, and what he said changed my entire life. Dad took mother's life and then took his own. I need you down here now. Wow. I got there. My brother was 15 years older than I. I was always the little brother. And he was a good Christian man. No, don't get me wrong. But when I walked in that front door, my brother, 15 years older than I, 60 years old, and I was 45, collapsed in my arms. And I'm standing there holding Dale, confused. How can this be? I'm not the older brother. I'm the little brother. Dale, what's going on? I was the one with strength. At the funeral, my sponsor, who had squeezed my shoulder, and his family, all of a sudden, over here, out of the corner of my eye, I saw something moving. And I looked over, and it was as if the arms of AA wrapped around me, because he looked at me, and I was sober, and he smiled. When he smiled, we both knew why he smiled. He was smiling at me, and he was telling me, you're sober, and I'm glad to see it. You know, after that, I had a thought, because I'm quite confident that my mother and my father talked about this. Dad took her life and then took his own because he couldn't stay. He'd be charged with murder. And I had the thought go through my mind, was I strong enough to do what my father had done? Maybe not to kill my wife, but was I strong enough? Because I was married to a lady who was very serious, and she had something that she said was, I don't ever want to be kept alive on a machine. Could I carry out the final wishes of my wife? Did I love her enough to do what he did? All I could do at that point, and I, who knows, was hope and pray that I never had to. Now, you might think that after that little seance that that would be the end of my tale. And I was sober, and boy, things were going good. Life was smooth and peaceful from that day forward. And it was a lot better. I have 3 boys. My middle son is in recovery. He's 8 years sober. My oldest son is also in recovery. He's 4 years. And I have a disgusting normie who is the youngest boy. My life as a sober member of AA did go along pretty smoothly for several years. My high school sweetheart and I were still married. I got active in service. I got active in our community. I joined the volunteer fire department. I was rodeo parade chairman. I worked Saturdays as an on-air personality at radio station KTIP. I was on the hospital board of directors in a public election. I was on the Tulare County Historical Society. I joined the Porterville Historical Museum. I was busy. I was doing things. I was a part of the community. I was sober. Things were going along. And then on August 6th last year, 2019, my life changed again by 180 degrees. On August 6th, the love of my life had a stroke. She had just gotten out of the bathtub, and I was getting ready to go outside and go to work around the ranch. I patted her on the shoulder, said, all right, I'll see you a little later. She was going to town to do something. I don't know, I think the PT, And I walked out in the kitchen, and the God that I believe in and that I listen to as best I can told me that I needed to empty the trash. Huh. Okay, I'll empty the trash before I go outside. So I reached under the sink. Isn't that where we all keep the trash? Pulled it out from under the sink. I better go into my bath and her bath and get the trash and put it in here, and then we can have them all empty. I walked in, got mine out of my bath, walked around, and here's my wife, stark naked, laying on the floor, collapsed. What in the world is going on? I rushed to her back, got her up, got her on my knees. There was nothing there. She was conscious, but there was, lights were on, but nobody was home. As we followed her down the highway, I came to a very startling discovery. I thought, as I'm following the ambulance down the road, you know, she might not get out of that ambulance alive. Wow. And I was surprised to find that I wasn't panicked, my heart wasn't pounding, that I was of the opinion of, I guess I'll just have to deal with that. And you know what? You guys are responsible for that, because you taught me that what is what and how it is how it is. And you got to do what you got to do. And I didn't have room to be panicked. At the hospital, the family arrived, of course. She had definite speech and memory problems, but I became everything to her. Ivan, to the point of helping her on and off the porta potty in the room, waiting until she was done, gloving up and providing the wiping duties, and then cleaning out the pan. I became everything for her. I defended her over a physical therapist in a way that I might not have done very well before. He was a jerk, no question. I did something very different. I went to the head nurse and I said very firmly, that man is never to come in my wife's room again. I didn't yell, I didn't swear, I didn't scream. I just simply laid down the law and said, this is what's got to happen. She spent 9 days in the ICU and on the telemetry floor, and then we transferred her to a stroke rehabilitation hospital in Bakersfield, which is 65 miles away from my home. For 12 days, she was in that stroke rehab. Every morning, I drove an hour and 15 minutes to get there, arrived by 7 a.m., and I walked her, if she was able to walk, or I put her in a wheelchair and wheeled her to breakfast. We went to the therapy sessions during the day. I went on all of those therapy sessions with her, and at lunch, I wheeled her or walked her to lunch. I stayed until the afternoon. Sometimes we took a nap in the afternoon if we could. And then at 5 o'clock, I would take her to dinner again. I would go back. I would go home and, I would start the morning the next day the same way. She was making good recovery. She got discharged from the stroke rehab to home. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday then, we were driving to a new rehab that had been approved by our insurance. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday of 1 week, we arrived by 9 and left by 4. She was doing very well with her speech, her cognitive skills, and her memory. She went Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then she went Monday, Wednesday, part day. Wednesday, part day, she had an appointment with an orthopedic doctor down in Santa Clarita, and it was a knee doctor, and she had a bad knee. He says, you know, you need a new D. I need a new knee. There you go. But not for about 6 months. It's too close to your stroke time. We want to wait a while. In 2017, she had had 100% bowel blockage. She had had an abdominal hysterectomy. She had had a gastric bypass, and she was a scar producer of great proportions. She woke me. Well, 2017, she had 100% bowel blockage. She spent 9 days in the hospital. I was able to spend those 9 days in the same room with her. We nearly lost her that time. In 2018, 13 months later, she had another bowel blockage. She spent 11 days in the hospital, and we almost lost her then. Midnight after the Wednesday of the orthopedic appointment, on Thursday morning, at about midnight, just a little after, she woke me, and she said, honey, my tummy hurts, and it's beginning to pooch a little bit. She was having another one. 2019, 18 months later, I'll get my tongue away with me here in a little bit. Thursday morning, We got her to the hospital as quickly as possible. They took an x-ray. They said she has a distended loop of bowel, which is very, very dangerous. If it ruptures, you've got all that fecal matter in the abdominal cavity, and it's big trouble. They said we need to do surgery, regardless of whether it's less than 8 weeks. She came out of surgery, and instead of going to the room where I would be able to join her, she went to ICU, and I was a little, that's not good. I had to go home because I didn't have any meds. I didn't have any clothes. I knew she was going to be in the hospital for a week or two. I'd have to have clothes to be there and stay with her. Friday morning, I was at home. I was getting ready. Hadn't slept at all well, needless to say. And I got a call from my middle son. I said, well, how's Mom doing? He said, not well, Dad. I've never seen her scared. She's scared. Wow. I said, I'll be right there. Needless to say. Doctors came in to me on Friday morning and they said, Brent, we're going to have to go in again. There's more problems. Friday afternoon after that second surgery and second anesthesia, she coded twice, but they brought her back. Saturday morning, we held on to hope for a little while, but her body was slipping into sepsis, which is just simply an overblown infection. The end game was becoming pretty obvious. The organs began to cascade into failure. She was a nurse from 1984 until her passing, 35 years. She always said, I never want to be kept alive on a machine. I never want to be in a bed and can't move. I know where I'm going. If I get that bed, let me go. Same command that my father got, just different way. Okay, same thing. And I was in that position. Before we got her ready for surgery on Thursday afternoon, she was sitting in the hospital. It had the x-ray. They found the extended bowel loop. She turned to me. And she said, honey, heaven forbid. I said, I got you, honey. I know what you're going to say. I knew what she was going to say. Don't let me go there. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, when we went in to look at her, her face was stretched. It was drawn. It was pinched. She hurt. She was uncomfortable. When we went in the room on Sunday morning, she looked totally different. She was at peace. I went into my boys. I have the three sons, and they were fantastic. I said, go look at Mom's face. Mom knows exactly what we are getting ready to do. She is ready. And the boys all went in and looked at her, and they all agreed. Sunday morning, we met with the palliative care doctor. That's end-of-life doctor. She told us, you know, it could take anywhere from 1 hour to 24 hours for her heart to stop beating. The family all had time to come in and visit with her, see her, speak to her, love on her. When they removed the last of the life support things, the time was 12:45 in the afternoon on Sunday. There were 12 of us around her bed. We were playing church music, old stuff, you know, old Rugged Cross, that stuff, things that she loved. And we were all standing around telling her we loved her and touching her. I went to her head three times. And I said, Sharon, the boys and I are going to be fine. If you got to go, you can go. At 1 p.m. sharp, 15 minutes later, the little nurse stepped in and she quietly said, she's gone. My wife of 54 and a half years had passed. My girlfriend of 58 and a half years was gone. From Thursday morning at midnight until Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. was a very short time, 3.5 days. But at least I was able to be there for her. Thanks to you. You gave me that strength. You gave me that guts, whatever. And the family was able to be there with her. God had been preparing me for my wife's passing since the first bowel blockage in 2017. I'm convinced of that. The second one in 2018, and I was becoming a little more prepared. And then when she had that stroke in August of last year in 2019, I realized, yeah, we might lose her. After the stroke, God had my life so organized that I could be her constant companion. I was able to be her everything, as I described to you. I was able to be there right by her side. I could help her bathe. I could help her as her driver. I could be her wheelchair attendant. I could take her to appointments. I had the time to take her to rehab every day. And ultimately, I was given the gift of grace and the duty to be able to drive her on her final trip to the hospital. During the 8 weeks after her stroke, God saw to it that we talked about important stuff. We never looked back when we started dating, and I was talking to you guys about that. We never, ever doubted each other. We might have been angry. We might have been upset. We might have been frustrated with each other. But there was never, ever a time, and we said this to each other during that 8 week period, there was never, ever a time when I didn't love you. I might have been upset. I might have been angry with you. But I never, ever didn't love you. We talked about a lot of important stuff. The day she passed away, God gave me the strength and the courage to tell her, okay, it's okay for you to go. The boys and I are okay. You can go. I had to be strong for her. But you know, I had three boys with families there. And I had to be strong for them so they could rely on Dad. Do I miss her? Of course. Do I feel lonesome? Yeah, sometimes. But you know, I am so tremendously grateful for what I have. God saw to it that I had 54 and a half years as her husband. We had 58 and a half years as boyfriend, girlfriend. That I was able to stay with the hospital, right with her in 2017 and 2018 and be right there beside her bed. I was able to be there with a minute when she had a stroke. I was calm and not panic-stricken after that stroke. In fact, one of my granddaughters, who I think is 19 now, came over and she cuddled up under my arm and we were watching Sharon in the bed and she was doing okay, but, you know, still had speech problems. And she said, looked up and she says, Grampy, that nurse over there said, you've got to be one of the calmest people she's ever seen in emergency. And that was a compliment from her, let me tell you. I was able to spend that 8 weeks right by her side. I could be entrusted with her life by letting her go. God left me with three amazing and strong young men and memories of a strong and beautiful woman, both inside and out. Where does all that gratitude and strength come from? It comes from 30 years of being in these rooms and listening to you talk about what you did. It comes from the members of AA. You know, the members of AA are just God with skin on. That's all it is. There's God right here in this room, all around. You guys represent God, whether you know it or not. Whether you believe it or not, trust me, you do. You taught me that it's okay to have a little emotion. If I'm feeling bad, you taught me to pick up a 10,000-pound telephone and make a phone call. You taught me that God is in charge and not Brent. Whoa, there's a surprise. And it's also that He's got you. He's taken care of this. Am I grateful that my wife has passed away? Of course not. But I am grateful. She lived and she put up with me for over half a century. I'm grateful she gave me three sons, three daughters-in-law, eight grandchildren, and even one little great-grand. I'm grateful you taught me it's okay to be emotional, to have feelings. You taught me not to look behind, but look ahead. I'm grateful you taught me to honor and respect her memory, which I do. And I'm grateful you've taught me to think about, what would Sharon want me to do? And I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to smile because God tells me I can. I'm going to open my heart because God says I should. And I'm going to love all of you because I already do. Thank you for, and God, let me say that again. Thank you and thank God for an attitude of gratitude. You have given me the world. Thank you.